All right, I'm just going to go ahead and get started. My name is Ethan Richardson, and I work for Mockingbird. I'm one of the mocking minions, and today I want to talk about Colbert. Does everybody watch, like, regularly Colbert? Yeah, okay. And I want to start just by showing a clip of some of his interviews, better know a senator or better know a district. And let's go ahead and show that.
First of all, Congressman Hare, is that your real name or is that some sort of hazing nickname they give the new guys?
No, that is my real name. Well, actually, my real name is Phil Hare. But
Phil Hare?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It kind of does sound like, it sounds like a made-up name. Phil Hare. It's like Phil McCracken.
No, it's Phil Hare.
Sure. Let's say a few things that would really lose the election for you if you were contested. But remember, you're not contested. There's no way you can lose.
Right.
I enjoy cocaine because...
I enjoy cocaine because...
You'll try without laughing because then people will think it's a joke.
Oh. Okay.
Describe your district in one word.
Hardworking is two words, isn't it?
That's two words, I'm afraid.
You appeared on PBS Frontline to discuss the meth epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
What are the ingredients in meth?
You can actually, believe it or not, Stephen, download a recipe on the internet.
What is that website?
If you were to Google or live search recipes for methamphetamine, you could probably find it.
Got it. Okay. Come on. Stand up for your rights as a Democratic congressman and say that you're a Republican.
I can't.
Just say you're a Republican. It's so much simpler.
I'm just not a Republican. It's hard for me to...
Come on.
As a Republican, I would support Hillary Clinton.
You said you joined a fraternity to meet girls. There are no girls in fraternities, for the record, Congressman. Whoever that was in the dress, I hate to be the one to break it to you here on television. That was a dude. Unlike the Democrats, I don't label people. I don't pigeonhole people. Democrats. By the way, people tell me you're black, but I don't see race. Are you black?
I'm black.
Chocolate thunder. I assume. Again, I don't see race.
Chocolate tastes good, though.
You know, is that a, what are you,
and you know
is
what?
That's part of the gay agenda?
You don't know. And you know why chocolate is good? Because you can eat brown chocolate or white chocolate. But it's still chocolate.
I'm getting very uncomfortable with this.
I don't want to smear my opponent.
I'll start. I'll do it for you.
Okay.
James Saxton is a notorious pedophile.
I'd rather talk about his record.
Okay, you don't care that he's a pedophile.
I have no way of knowing, and I have
and
no knowledge
care.
That he is.
You don't care?
Well, I would care if he was, but I have no knowledge that he is.
You don't even want to find out?
I think we ought to stick to the issues in this election.
And let the pedophiles just roam free.
I'm not in favor.
Would you care to debate me?
Sure.
Okay. Welcome to Colbert and Yarmouth. I'm Stephen Colbert. With me,
John Yarmouth.
Tonight's subject, throwing kittens in a wood chipper. I'm against it. I think it's wrong. John, tear me a new one.
Well, you know, there are times when you have to find a way to dispose of kittens. And sometimes the only thing that you can do, if you don't have a shovel, if you don't have a garbage can, but if there's a wood chipper handy, then you're going to have to use the wood chipper.
Wow. Congressman, thank you for taking care of those kittens.
It was my pleasure.
And a final thought on that from Becky, the Cleveland okay. TV kitten.
The couple is going to have to come right.
Okay, all right. That's unrelated. But so we've all seen Colbert, and that's actually probably one of my favorite segments that he does is when he goes to Washington and interviews. But as you know, Stephen Colbert plays Stephen Colbert, a political pundit, and the opening credits kind of show it all. You know, he's decked out like a political pundit. He's got the American flag, like a javelin, and he's like jumping through all these hyperboles. You know, mega American or superstantial, and. It is an incredibly popular show, and I would say that most many, if not most, of the people my age get their news from either Stephen Colbert or Jon Stewart. And it's been on since 2005. It's been nominated for an Emmy since 2006. Besides just the fact that, like, it's funny, it seems like there's two layers of commentary always going on. One is the news that he's commenting on. But the other thing is this term that's now an actual term called truthiness, which is basically the notion that you believe something to be true just because of instinct or because of your gut, you know, as opposed to there being rational evidence or a reason for you to believe it. So whether it's, you know, lately, and I'm going to show this clip pretty soon, the Washington Redskins have, you know, been given a lot of flack for the fact that they haven't changed their football team's name. And so Stephen Colbert, after news that the Redskins had created this charity for Native American people, he said that he was going to create a charity called the Ching Chong Ding Dong charity for Orientals or whatever. And basically pointing out the fact that, you know, it's not enough just to do that. It's just kind of a half answer for the Redskins to create this charity and not do the thing that they're being asked to do. And there was a huge backlash with Colbert's fans. I don't know if you heard about all this, but the hashtag cancel Colbert, and everybody was really upset that he was being a racist himself. And so I want to talk about that, how at that moment satire didn't seem to work. But I also want to be quick with my analysis because I want to hear what you guys think. I mean, really what's so amazing about satire is, I mean, you have this character, this caricature, or this made-up circumstance that then speaks and makes people laugh. People laugh first, but then there is always some edge, some offensive edge that's intended. And a lot of times people are a lot more open to think about those criticisms when the joke comes first. So we'll talk about that later, but let's go ahead and play that second clip. This is him talking about hashtag cancel Colbert.
And folks, internet equality is more important than ever, as I learned this weekend when the interwebs tried to swallow me whole. But I am proud to say that I got lodged in its throat and it hacked me back up like a hastily chewed chicken wing. This is Who's Attacking Me Now? Tonight, to find out what happened to me on the internet, we turn to the TV.
People are calling for Stephen Colbert's show to be canceled after a tweet about Asians appeared on the Comedy Central Twitter account.
The hashtag cancel Colbert is trending this morning.
The hashtag cancel Colbert is trending.
Cancel Colbert is a hashtag that was trending.
Hashtag cancel Colbert went viral.
But folks, I'm still here. The dark forces. Boom, boom. It's all because of you people. The dark forces trying to silence my message of core conservative principles mixed with youth-friendly product placement have been thwarted. Went through a few of these this weekend. But folks, I'm not gonna lie. This was close. We almost lost me. I'm never going to take me for granted ever again. Here's what happened to me. Last Wednesday, I saluted Washington Redskins owner Daniel Snyder for his new charity, the Washington Redskins Original Americans Foundation. which some have called an obvious attempt to win over Native Americans because it only uses the term Redskins once in its name. Now, I have my own racial misunderstanding with the Asian community over a long-running and beloved character on my show. Very important, he is a character. He is not me. This is the real Stephen Colbert. I mean everything I say on this show. He means, well, you'd have to ask him, and he's not returning my calls right now. Anyway, I was so inspired by Dan Snyder's charitable outreach that I formed my own charity, the Ching Chong Ding Dong Foundation for Sensitivity to Orientals or whatever. That was Wednesday. It reran four times on Thursday, was posted on the show's Facebook page, not a peep out of the internet. Then, around 7 o'clock on Thursday, my network's promotional Twitter account, at Colbert Report, tweeted the name of my foundation without providing a video link to the original segment or mentioning that I was inspired by the Redskins charity. I mean, who would have thought a means of communication limited to 140 characters would ever create misunderstandings? But folks, I have never once used at Colbert Report. As you heroes know, I'm at Stephen at home. Though, full disclosure, I sometimes tweet from at Stephen at home, at work, in bathroom. Then, after that, when the twit hit the fan, the don't want to get too far away from me. The brain trust over at my network took the tweet down because that's how the internet works. You can just take stuff down and no one will ever know it happened. Just ask Mayor Wiener. Now, I'm not trying to throw anyone under the bus here, mostly because I don't go that close to public transportation. But when I saw the tweet with no context, I understood how people were offended. The same way I, as an Irish American, was offended after reading only one line of Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal. I mean, eat Irish babies, hashtag cancel Swift. Trend it. Now, all of this was started by a hashtag activist, or hashtivist, who has been viciously attacked on Twitter. And if anyone is doing that for me, I want you to stop right now. She's just speaking her mind, and that's what Twitter's for, as well as ruining the ending of every show I haven't seen yet. Now, the Cancel Colbert people think that even in context, I am a racist. I just want to say that I am not a racist. I don't even see race, not even my own. People tell me I'm white, and I believe them because I just devoted 6 minutes to explaining how I'm not a racist. Now, once... And that is about the whitest thing you can do. Now, once the Cancel Colbert hashtag got rolling, it was one of the top five trends for more than 36 hours because everybody wants to talk about the king. Then... It was picked up by a small group of Americans who get their information only from Twitter, the news media. There were online stories in the USA Today, The New Yorker, Variety, Slate, The Huffington Post, three features on Time.com, and seven on Salon. CNN even took a break from their Malaysian airliner coverage to report spotting what they thought was the wreckage of my show off the coast of Australia. Now, but, and most hurtful, my fellow conservatives abandoned me in my time of need. Like Michelle Malkin, who co-signed on to Cancel Colbert and called me a coward. This cuts deep, especially since I learned everything I know about sensitivity to the Asian American experience from reading Michelle's 2004 book, In Defense of Internment. Before, it turns out they had it coming. One less thing for me to feel guilty about. Now, to recap, a web editor I've never met posts a tweet in my name on an account I don't control outrages a hashtag activist, and the news media gets 72 hours of content. The system worked. But all this started right after I taped Thursday night's show, so I couldn't respond until today. So in a sense, I was canceled for 3 days, just like Jesus.
Okay. I mean, there's just so much to talk about from that one clip. I mean, not only about Colbert and his character and the things that he does with his character, but, I mean, specifically for the identity conference, you know. But one thing that I thought about when I was preparing for this, Diane Rehm was interviewing Wendell Berry, I guess a couple years ago, and he said something to the effect of, I would really love to see someone running for office who was willing to lose for the sake of being speaking clearly, for the sake of speaking clearly. And I think that what Colbert is doing is he has become a caricature of the non-example of that. And by doing so, by sort of magnifying the ugly, which is satire, he speaks truth to power, you know. So, and this is satire. I mean, it's not a new way of doing things. It's as old as the Romans. And I was talking to someone earlier this week about satire being in the Bible. I mean, the moment where I think it's Nathaniel is talking to King David, or Nathan. And he tells this story, and the story is the story of injustice, and it's about David. It's about David and Bathsheba, and David's response is like, that man should be killed. And then what does Nathan says? You are the man, you know. So satire kind of works to show that there is sort of like there's a round hole and there's a square peg, and it's not fitting. You know, and there's an ought, there's a way things ought to be, and there's a way things are, and sort of the art of satire is to distract people enough to see that this isn't working, that this doesn't fit, and that after they see that, in some sort of witty way, it doesn't have to be funny, but in some way that diverts their attention, they see the truth, and then they can see it in themselves. So in satire, there's the satiric target and then the satiric norm. And that's kind of the square peg, round hole thing. I mean, the ought and the is. The satiric norm is the way things ought to be. And the target is, this is actually how it is. And as long as you can show that they aren't matching up, that things aren't fitting the way they should be, you can then start to see what's gone wrong. And one of the things that Colbert says about his show, the AV Club interviewed him, and he talks about his set this way. Status is always ripe for satire. Status is always good for comedy. And they have the highest possible status. And that's what we've tried to amplify with everything on the show. Everything on the show has my name on it, every bit of the set. We just try everything we can to pump up my status on the show. There are no televisions behind me like the way Brian Williams has, or even Jon Stewart. At certain angles, there are monitors behind Jon for The Daily Show that have the world going on, which implies that that's where the news is, and that's where the information is, and the person in front of it is the conduit through which this information is given to you. But on my set, I said, I don't want anything behind me because I am the sun. It all comes from me. I'm not channeling anything. I am the source. So, I mean, that's really, I mean, it's really profound that, you know, he's caught on to something deeper than what some of these other pundit shows are doing. But they're all doing the same thing. It's not a news show, it's a personality show. And they have sort of become the news. So they talk about whatever they want to talk about, and truthiness reigns. But it's always the intent of satire to offend. It's not just to say, like, oh, that's really interesting that he, like, pointed that out. It's always to offend someone. So there's this playwright, Italian playwright. His name's Dario Fo, and he said about satire, the playwright is doing something where you can tell real satire from teasing. In real satire, you create an outraged or violent reaction, and that the more they try to stop you, the better job you're doing. Historically, people in positions of power have welcomed and encouraged good-humored buffoonery, while modern-day people in positions of power have tried to censor, ostracize, and repress satire. So the idea being that in terms of satire, unless you're pissing someone off, you're not doing your job. And the more you're angering people, the deeper to the heart of the matter you're getting. And has anybody read Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travels? All right, I'm going to read a little bit from Gulliver's Travels. If you're not familiar, he basically goes and travels to all these different nations that are symbolized by the different nations he sees every day. And Gulliver is kind of this Colbert character. I mean, he's totally self-involved, and he sees the Lilliputians, this land that is supposed to mimic Britain, and they're these tiny little people, and their issues are tiny, but they fight these really long battles over them, and he has this one moment where he describes what he calls the engine, and it's this huge, I mean, he basically prophesies a word processor. I mean, this huge wooden screen that has these words, and people are sort of really anxiously trying to put the words together. And in this weird way, in the 1700s, he has sort of described modern technological anxiety. But I want to read this one from, he goes to this floating island called Laputa. And it's floating, and I think the symbolism is that these people are just the type of people that think and create and feel. And the way he describes them is their eyes. One eye is always looking inward, and one eye is always looking upward. Like they're turned in on themselves. They only think about themselves and their issues and sort of the kind of worthless academic thoughts that are going on in their mind. All right, I'm going to read this. Let me find it real quick. At my alighting, I was surrounded with a crowd of people, but those who stood nearest seemed to be of better quality. They beheld me with all the marks and circumstances of wonder. Neither, indeed, was I much in their debt, having never till then seen a race of mortals so singular in their shapes, habits, and countenances. Their heads were all reclined, either to the right or the left. One of their eyes turned inward, and the other directly up to the zenith. Their outward garments were adorned with the figures of suns, moons, and stars, interwoven with those of fiddles, flutes, harps, trumpets, guitars, and many other instruments of music, unknown to us in Europe. I observed here and there many in the habit of servants with a blown bladder fastened like a flail to the end of a stick, which they carried in their hands. In each bladder was a small quantity of dried peas or little pebbles, as I was afterwards informed. With these bladders, they now and then flapped the mouths and ears of those who stood near them, of which practice I could not then conceive the meaning. It seems the minds of these people are so taken up with intense speculations that they neither can speak nor attend to the discourses of others without being roused by some external taction upon the organs of speech and hearing. For which reason, those persons who are able to afford it always keep a flapper in their family. as one of their domestics, nor ever walk abroad or make visits without him. And the business of this officer, the flapper, is when two, three, or more persons are in company, gently to strike with his bladder the mouth of him who is to speak in the right ear of him or them to whom the speaker addresses himself. This flapper is likewise employed diligently to attend his master in his walks, and upon occasion to give him a soft flap on his eyes, because he is always so wrapped up in cogitation that he is in manifest danger of falling down every precipice. So he's on this floating island, and there's all these people. They have a servant. Each like wealthy man has a servant who has basically a paddle, because these people are so turned inward on themselves and so focused on their thoughts and their feelings. They need someone to slap them in the head to keep them from walking into things. And I actually was thinking about this and walking into the church yesterday, and someone walked into a tree right outside the church because they were on their phones. And it's funny. I mean, satire, one of the things that makes satire so beautiful is sort of its ability to prophesy, not just to explain what's going on now, but to say this is the way people are always going to be. And then I also thought, well, The Onion does this so well. I mean, this is a title from a couple years ago that we put on the site. Area man putting huge amount of pressure on self to excel at completely meaningless activity, which totally relates to, one, the Laputa people, but also bracketology and, all the various things that we pour so much energy into that mean absolutely nothing. Syracuse, New York. According to sources, area man James Hargraves, 34, is pushing himself far too hard to succeed at the completely trivial and pointless multiplayer board game, The Settlers of Catan. I'm blowing it. Why can't I harvest these crops right? The intensely focused and competitive man said about the ultimately meaningless thing that has no real bearing on his life whatsoever. I just have to keep building roads. That's the key. Can't get behind. At press time, Hargraves was searching online for strategies to improve his performance at the utter waste of his time and energy. Again, there's the double layer here, too, that I was talking about with Colbert. There's the focus of the attention, like this guy doing something meaningless. But also the way that The Onion works is, what is news on The Onion is always about area man or area woman. It's always about a person. And so sort of the greater project of The Onion seems to be that we are always inveterately looking at our own lives as the news. That's just the way we are. It's not the global issues. It's the questions of identity and the things that we really think about, or the things that we're anxious about, or the things that don't matter so much. But with Swift's audience and with, the folks that read The Onion, the people who watch Colbert, we always laugh first. And that's something I want to get your opinion on, but what is the significance about laughing first and then being able to see the significance of what's being said? And part of what I think it is, maybe, is that there is kind of this, whenever satire is around, it's criticism, it's condemnation. You're pointing out something that's wrong and should be fixed. But the force of the condemnation is put on something else. You tell a story, or you create this character, in the case of Colbert, who bears all of the condemnation. They become the antithesis, And by doing so, we're able to laugh at this character or this situation that's not real. And because it's sort of been taken away from it being a personal attack on us, we then begin to see it as something, well, maybe that's true, and possibly that's true about me too. So, and then also, it seems like satire, because it's doing that, is always descriptive. It's describing something as opposed to prescribing something. a prescription is always directed at the person to say, you know, you need to change in this way and then you will get better. Whereas Colbert is, you know, he is the sun. The cameras are on him. Everything is focused on him. And he is describing in his very character what we are not. And then we're able to see it. So with that being said, I want to play the next clip, which is him talking about his super PAC. And it's kind of this beautiful, he's not a player in the game. Like, that's what's so interesting about Colbert, is that he's not a political pundit. He's a comedian, he's an actor. But by doing these things, he enters the realm and can totally, like, someone who is completely innocuous to the game can actually speak to it. So can we play that clip?
It was fun. It was a really fun night.
But from that point, something happened in America. You and John Stewart.
I'm sorry, Lino. It's the fourth one, not the third one. This is the wrong one.
And the big finish tonight, Stephen Colbert has a bit of a problem. His name does not appear on the South Carolina primary ballot, and the state doesn't allow write-in candidates. So how can he continue to run for president of the United States of South Carolina? Well, with the help of Herman Cain. Cain is still on the ballot in South Carolina, and Colbert is now asking his supporters to vote for the pizza man.
Because Cain and I are so similar, I think that if this Saturday Herman Cain were to get a significant number of votes, that would be a sign that voters are hungry. Hungry. Hungry for a Stephen Colbert campaign. Anybody who shares my values can show it by voting for Herman Cain.
Well, as for Herman Cain, you know, he thinks it's a great idea. Cain will tape a segment for the Colbert Report in South Carolina on Friday, tweeting this caveat: to be perfectly clear, I will not be assuming Stephen Colbert's identity. We are very different when it comes to the color of our hair. Colbert's super PAC, now run by John Stewart, released this ad explaining the situation to voters.
There is one name on the ballot that stands for true Americaninity, Herman Cain. Americans for a Better Tomorrow Tomorrow believes a vote for Herman Cain is a vote for America. On January 21st, vote Herman Cain.
Watch the smile grow.
Let's get some insight from Ari Melber, correspondent for The Nation magazine, and Democratic strategist Crystal Ball, also with us tonight. You know, the poll shows Obama at 41%, Romney at 38%. This is PPP poll. And Colbert at 13%. Will this alter the outcome, Ari, on Saturday in South Carolina?
He could take a bite out of it. This was actually the plot of an Eddie Murphy movie, The Distinguished Gentleman, where they said, you know, if you have the right name ID and you say you're the other candidate, you can win as him. In that case, it was one who'd passed away. And Herman Cain, again, shows he's not very serious about this since he's playing along.
Sure. And, of course, if you never know, Stephen Colbert could finish ahead of Rick Perry.
Hey, it's not unheard of. Maybe you should throw your hat in the ring, Ed. John Huntsman's name is up for grabs on the ballot.
Yeah, really. Here's what Mitt Romney had to say about coordinating with the super PAC last month.
I'm not allowed to communicate with the super PAC in any way, shape, or
form. So you're not coordinating in any way whatsoever?
My goodness. If we coordinate in any way whatsoever, we go to the big house.
Colbert and Stewart, they proved how easy it is to not coordinate last night.
I can't tell you, but I can tell everyone through television. And if you happen to be watching, well, I can't prevent that, John. Oh, I have an idea. Okay, hold on a second. I am calling on the super PAC. I cannot coordinate with them. I can't communicate directly, but I can speak out as a citizen talking to you. And I am calling on them not to run vicious character assassination ads that impugn and borderline slander any candidate if in any way those ads could be traced back to me.
I mean, we are at the point now, Crystal, in American politics where two comedians are doing more to help the process than the politicians are, to help Americans understand exactly what the hell is going on out here.
Although, in fairness to the Republican nominees, one of the most beautiful things out of this campaign, in a campaign that has not been very beautiful, has been seeing them all up on stage complaining about super PACs and themselves highlighting the role of money in politics. But also, political satire has a long history in American culture and American politics. Stephen Colbert has done an amazing job really pointing out the absurdity of the situation and making it very real for a lot of people.
So, will this change anything, Ari?
Yeah. I mean, I think, number one, it's going to scramble things in South Carolina a touch. If Herman Cain picks up even 3 or 4 points, we're going to hear complaints about who that took votes from. And then the other piece is, I agree with Crystal, you know, most folks don't care about process that much, right? People don't worry about media bias until they feel the bias hits something they care about. And so the process of super PACs is arcane, but the absurdities that are on display are huge.
Could we see the Democratic president, Barack Obama, and the Republican nominee, whoever it may be, broker a deal to cool it?
I would love to see that, and there was a call for that by Andy Rosenthal at the New York Times saying, what about a mutual non-aggression pact? Ultimately, it's got to be in the law, though.
Crystal, what do you think?
Well, I think that's a possibility, and the other piece I want to throw into this is you have Americans Elect, which is likely to be on the ballot in 50 states. Someone with a big personality like Stephen Colbert could very well get the Americans Elect nomination and have a big impact in the general election.
Crystal Ball, Ari Melber, thanks so much.
Okay. The only reason I show that is not... obviously not for partisan reasons, but just to show how someone who is completely disinterested in being a politician can actually become one by sort of making fun of it, you know? And I think the Shakespearean fool is someone that really comes to mind thinking about Colbert, someone who is always the wise one speaking next to the king, and can point out sort of the brokenness and the vulnerabilities of power. And it's ironic because the fool has no power, but precisely because the fool has no power, there's nothing to lose. So in the same way with Colbert being a comedian, because power is not attainable or not wanted, it's exactly why he has this disguise to speak to like the movers and the shakers of the world, because he is somewhat irrelevant. He's able to be relevant, which is kind of crazy. I want to show this clip. He was interviewed by Google. Google does these things called Google Talks, and this is Stephen Colbert, not Colbert, and he's talking about his character and also sort of the reaction, why Washington hates him. And it seems to be because there are these serious, like, straight-line power movers, and all of a sudden your feathers kind of get ruffled when someone like this, who is making light of the whole deal, it's disrupting. So let's go ahead and play that one. This should be the third clip.
It was fun. It was a really fun night.
But from that point, something happened in America. You and Jon Stewart actually became the major political operatives, whether you like it or not.
No, I don't.
Well,
trust
me.
I'm a comedian. I'm not a political operative. I make jokes about the news. A lot of the news is about politics. That's not my fault.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? If a political operative means that you have some game beyond what you're doing. Politics itself means I am not telling you my intention. I am showing you an action that is causing a reaction from you while I'm playing another chess piece over here. And together I will triangulate some secretive way where I will achieve power over you. I mean, you know, political action is class against class. I'm not trying to get power over anybody. That's why I don't like the idea of political actor in any way. I'm making jokes. I'm trying to make you laugh about something that I care about.
The fact of the matter is that the trusted organizations of our society have been replaced by you and John.
Bullshit. And
I'll tell you why.
Am I
right?
Because if that was true, they would know.
Come on. behind it.
That's lovely. That's lovely, but I know. But this, people have asked me this before, and I don't think that's true. Because if people got, like, if that was the case, people wouldn't get my jokes. Because I'm not explaining that much to you. First of all, you have to know what I'm referencing to understand half of my joke. And two, I don't explain the news story that well to you. People come to me with knowledge. They might enjoy watching the show more than they enjoy watching straight news, but they had to have gotten news someplace else before they get to me, or else they wouldn't care.
But independent of whether I'm right or you're right, the fact of the matter is...
No, I'm right. You know, it matters who's right, I think. It matters who's right. Because this is what's wrong with news. They say, like, you know, independent of who's right, let's talk about something. No, someone's right.
Okay, I'm
saying you're the problem, Eric Schmidt. That's what I just said.
let's agree that there's an issue between you now and sort of the Washington establishment, because you have enormous reach, right? So
I got to be careful where I point this thing, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Because it's loaded.
Wag the finger.
Yeah, wag the finger. Yeah,
wag
exactly,
the finger.
Yeah.
And so do you think it's you and Washington sort of oil and water? How do you think it plays out?
Man, they don't seem to like it when I go down there. They're never that thrilled when I show up. So I don't know if we're oil and water, but it's not my world, you know. I don't have any desire to have political power. I don't have any desire, you know. People thought John and I were doing that rally to be players and to, you know, we were accused of trying to actuate the youth vote and to take, like, to drive people to the polls to win for the Democrats, and we've got this power. How will we exercise this political vote gun that we've got with 250,000 people on the mall and all this attention? And, you know, it just reminded me of, you know, I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan, as people sometimes know. And there's a great moment in the Lord of the Rings where, you know, if there's somebody here who doesn't know the plot, they got a ring, they're trying to destroy it to get rid of Sauron. Some people, I mean, listen, 10 years ago, people were going, oh, yeah, what's that story about? And, this is important. there's a meeting right before, there's a meeting toward the end of it. Gandalf says to everybody here, everybody in the meeting, it's Aragorn and some other people, and he goes, listen, our only hope for Frodo and Sam to succeed is that Sauron cannot imagine anyone would want to destroy the ring. He can't imagine. We don't want this power. And when people kept on saying, what's their intention with this rally? It's like, we're just Frodo and Sam.
Yeah.
You know, Washington is Mordor. We're trying to throw the ring. We're trying to throw the ring of divisiveness into the fires of Mount Maul.
So why can't we just sort of fly the Great Eagles into... Why can't they just fly Frodo into Mordor and throw the ring in?
Yeah.
Solve this problem?
Because he would be... They'd see him coming, and the Nazgul have flying steeds.
I don't think DC has any Nazguls.
Oh, you're back to the metaphor. I thought you were talking about something important, the Lord of the Rings.
Okay, so I just thought this sounds really familiar. This is Mark 4. He told them, the secret of the kingdom of God has been given to you, but to those on the outside, everything is said in parables, so that they may be ever seeing but never perceiving, and ever hearing but never understanding. Otherwise, they might turn and be forgiven. And it seems to me that Colbert is this character. I mean, he is the ever seeing but never perceiving non-example in all of Jesus's parables. You know, he's the Pharisee that can understand the language of power being useless. He's the elder brother that stands outside the house with his arms crossed because the younger brother hasn't earned this dinner party. And he's also the rich young ruler who has good intentions, but when it comes down to laying everything down and dying, he just can't do it. And Colbert describes his character as you'll see in this last clip, as a well-informed, high-class, well-intentioned idiot. And why don't we go ahead and play that, and then I want to hear what you guys think.
Did you have a question? Yes, go ahead.
What is the difference between Stephen Colbert, the person, and Stephen Colbert, the character? And what were the challenges in you becoming Stephen Colbert, the character?
There are a lot of differences, I hope, between me and my character. I mean, there's some things we have in common. We're both from South Carolina. We're both fans of Tolkien's work, though I tried to keep that separate at first. I tried to keep that membrane at first. I was like, no, I don't want, that's too important to me. I don't want him to have that. But there were too many opportunities for me to wax about it, so I went ahead and let that membrane be, permeable. But we're both super Catholics. He thinks he's Captain Catholic. I still go to church. And I happen to know I'm a fairly, I'm not particularly pious or devout Catholic, though I still go. He's a well-intentioned, poorly informed, high-status idiot. And I'd like to think I'm well-intentioned. I'm better informed than he is. He is completely incurious about the world. He is living an unexamined life, and that's fine with him. He's high status. I really enjoy being low status. I really enjoy playing a weak character. That's why I really enjoy him, is that he is this unbelievably self-important character. In fact, when Jim Fenhagen, who designed the Republican set this year, and he does the Olympics, he's a huge set designer, and he's a wonderful guy, an old friend of mine. I said to him when he was designing my first set, I said, I want your inspiration to be Da Vinci's Last Supper. I said, because if you look at Da Vinci's Last Supper, Christ has no halo. Existence, all of creation is his halo, because there are all these converging lines in the room and in reality that converge upon Christ's head as all of, as the world is God's footstool, as it says in Matthew, the world is Christ's halo. And so I said, I want my whole set to be like a halo around me. So if you look at my original set, there are these convergent lines that come in my set, and we painted it on the floor so I could be, I am the rising sun. There are no television monitors behind me. I'm not what Brian Williams or even John said. He's got television monitors behind him, and he's conveying the news to you. He's a conduit. I am the news. I am a dawn into my own day. But that's the outward status of the character. But his weakness and his incuriousness and his thin-skinned quality weakens in such wonderful ways. And I love that weakness, because I think that's the reality of me. I think I'm actually. I'm not as well defined as he is, and I enjoy copping to that in my own behavior.
Okay. Well, the word that stuck out for me in that clip is incurious, and I've read a little bit of Walker Percy, but one of the ways he describes despair is the man who rides the train to and from work every day and doesn't, live sort of the routine life and never actually has come to grips with the fact that he is despairing or that his life it doesn't matter, And because he hasn't actually been curious enough to see himself, to see the truth about himself, and to actually feel the weight of his despair, that is true despair. And so by becoming this character, by sort of blowing this character up, by making a set that makes himself Jesus, self-righteousness at its highest, Colbert shows us ourselves, And I don't know that everyone sees that, I don't think that everybody watching the show really comes to grips with the fact that, I'm kind of like that idiot Colbert, I'm kind of like him. I totally view my life as the news. Stephen Colbert broke his wrist, Stephen Colbert broke his wrist, but then he used it as this great avenue to have all this material on the show. He made these wrist bracelets and got celebrities to wear those, Live Strong bracelets, but it said, Wrist Strong or something like that. Because he is the news in his own life, So, yeah, by becoming the example, he actually gives the truth to his audience. And I want to hear from you guys, what does that look like in real life for your conversation with your spouse or your conversation with your community, yourself. What does satire have to say about telling the truth to the people in our lives? And also preaching, you know, because satire is basically bringing the law down, what is an effective way of sort of delivering the law to a congregation? Because we know that this kind of straight line invective way of preaching doesn't work, you know, it makes people either self-justify or stop coming. And so is there a sort of priestly self-satire that can happen from the pulpit? Can the priest stand up? And I interviewed a Lutheran minister a couple weeks ago, and she said the way that she views preaching the law is that every Sunday morning, she has prepared a sermon that makes her the first person to get hit by the bus of the law. And that preaching is exhausting because every time you get up there, you are killing yourself. Or you are the first one to sort of lay down before the righteous God. And I really liked that. And I think that's kind of a way that it shows itself. I'm going to read one more quote. This one's from Robert Farrar Capon. And then I want to hear what you guys think. He's talking about the difference between what he calls left-handed power and right-handed power. Unlike the power of straight argument, left-handed power is precisely paradoxical power, power that looks for all the world like weakness, intervention that seems indistinguishable from non-intervention. More than that, it is guaranteed to stop no determined evildoers whatsoever. It might, of course, touch and soften their hearts. But then again, it might not. It certainly didn't for Jesus. And if you decide to use it, you should be quite clear that it probably won't for you either. So with that in mind and thinking about what do you think about Colbert? What do you think about the nature of satire? What do you think about those questions I just asked in regards to thinking about this in your own life? Yeah, Zach. Oh, here's a mic.
I haven't connected them up yet. Yeah, but I think they do. One is that, and you gestured at this a couple times, but Colbert's criticism, especially of the politicians, ends up implicating the people who are laughing. They end up implicating us. I don't play Settlers of Catan, but I make it a point and get really freaked out if I can't, you know, see every Texas football game.
Yeah, yeah.
Which really has no impact on everything, especially now that they're bad. But you know.
It's true.
And I think Twitter should be burned in a fire. I think it's a waste of time. But a lot of those people who were laughing at that in those audience, they twit or tweet mm-hmm. whatever you say.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who make fun of who watch Jon Stewart and Colbert watch the news. Watch the sort of entertainment show that is MSNBC, Fox News, and CNN. Mm-hmm. I think most sort of, I hate to be the sort of turd in the punch bowl, if you will, but a lot of the jokes that are made about politicians, we created those people. They're mm-hmm. playing to a market. Mm-hmm. I individually may not like what they say, but the sort of diatribe against Washington is something that our body politic helped create.
Yeah,
and we all talk about our dislike for politicians who walk a certain line, but establishment candidates can always get elected, and maybe that's not a bad thing, because I actually think a lot of the sort of ruffle feathers candidates actually shouldn't be in office. But I do think that the jokes we make about politicians and laughing at this sort of thing sometimes is like a repository for our guilt or our perfectionism about what we expect out of these people that we mm-hmm. created. Mm-hmm. And so nobody really notices that when they watch these shows.
Yeah.
We're sort of just participating and making fun of these people that mm-hmm. that we put in place. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that satire is supposed to to provoke laughter, but there's oftentimes, there's usually, and I think you see this in satirists throughout history, but there's usually a deep strain of sadness among people who come up with satire because mm-hmm. that mismatch between the round peg and the square hole, that's a deeply grieved fact about the world. Now, the laughter may, it probably has different functions. It, so to speak, you laugh to keep from crying, and sometimes it's a little bit funny just so that you won't, you know, get too steeped in the despair. But it makes sense. To me, it's only fitting that this the wisest character in the greatest of all tragedies, King Lear, is the fool.
And
to me, it couldn't be any other way, because facing these things head on is actually just too hard to take, and so you have to figure out a way to laugh at them. But I bet you, Stephen Colbert, I bet you, deep in his, the young lady asked about him as an individual instead of as a character, I bet you he's introverted and somber and like a different person when he's not in front of the audience. But it's a hard thing to express at a cocktail party or in front of an audience, so you have to revert to making fun of things.
Right. Thank you, Zach.
And I promise those have implications for how we treat our wives and preach and stuff like that. But I'll let somebody else.
Yeah. No, it's funny. I go to Christ Episcopal Church in Charlottesville, and almost all of our church's sermons have some sort of onion reference. And it's just because they've been proven to work, you know. Everybody laughs, and I haven't thought about it that way, that the laugh implicates, you know. But it's so true. And like Paul's talk this morning, the one about the Onion article about regret. And we laugh, but it's kind of an awkward laugh because we totally understand what it is to sort of live with mistakes you've made or the lives that are unlived. So is anybody else? Yeah.
I hope this connects to what you were just saying, but I remember a quote Tim Keller said at one point that there has to come a point in the life of a Christian where you can laugh at your own sin. Mm. And in that sense, for me, satire and humor is actually like a gift from God, like a form of grace or maybe even forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. One thing I thought, too, with that in mind is that a lot of times the satire, the laughing at your own sin is also in some way kind of a remembering in the face of the law that it's not, we don't just believe in the law and that we are crushed by the law. So the humor comes into play because it's like, I'm totally hit by the bus there, but I'm laughing because like, thank God that's not the end of the story, you know? Yeah. Thanks for doing that, Lino.
As you talked about the role of the preacher, I think that's exactly it. And it kind of goes towards Capon's story of Arthur before the Great White Throne. Jesus calls him out in that way because he's still worried about the projection of himself. Colbert and this sort of thing is a gift because that person doesn't care about the power that comes from this. They care about the effect, I think. And even if they don't care about it consciously, it's what they're called to do, much like the preacher. You don't care about the power of giving this message to the people for yourself, but you care about the effect that it has on them when they can come to laugh at themselves, laugh at their sin, realize the desperation, and then hear the gospel on top of it.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, someone else described this need for humor in the pulpit, and not just the church pulpit, but in a situation too where you're needed to give a consoling word or needed as some sort of presence to speak into someone's life, that this humor that is also giving the truth kind of creates a space or an opening wherein people can sort of welcome in the truth. You know, you get to the heart first, and something about that helps you know that you're their friend, you know, and then the law comes. I don't know. But I do think there's something true about creating some space to then hear.
I find it honorable that he is so committed to presenting the message of the Colbert on TV that he's willing to suffer the insult or the misunderstanding of who he really is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it sounds familiar. You know, it's like, I really didn't want to make Colbert sound too much like Jesus, because it's kind of easy to do, especially if you watch that Hobbit clip, you know, where he's explaining quite beautifully what this is all about, you know, like, but it's hard not to quote the Bible and say, like, you know, well, wisdom didn't work with people, so God made foolishness to speak wisdom to them.
One thing I liked about Stephen Colbert is he really highlights how we're so egocentric, both as people and as a culture. You know, the sad part is you watch regular news or good news, quote unquote, like from New York City, and it's awful. You know, mm-hmm. It's Miley Cyrus got this haircut, and two dogs, you know, were abused in South Bronx or something. Yeah. It's just so pathetic and laughable, but it's sad because we're missing real news that's happening in Ukraine or Turkey.
Right.
And we're so egocentric as a culture, and I love his satire because he's just open about it, whereas the others are taking themselves seriously, mm-hmm. and it's pathetic, you know? But it really indicts us, and we do take ourselves seriously and post the right things on Facebook,
etc. Yeah, and it's also interesting that in those scenarios, one thing you should watch when you get home is he goes on Bill O'Reilly's show. Bill O'Reilly interviews him. Maybe you've seen it, but there just seems to be this, like, disconnect, like, there's totally no understanding of what it is exactly that Colbert is up to, but it's not to be trusted, you know, and something to watch. But I think it's really interesting how the power structures not only don't do what he's doing, but don't understand what he's doing. It's like speaking two totally different languages. All right. Any more comments?
I think I was thinking as you and as you said, the humor kind of gets the foot in the door and creates the crack to have the real exploration. I couldn't help but think of Louis C.K. Mm-hmm. and his interview with Conan, where he talks about not getting his children's cell phones and how brilliant. And absurd and yet brilliant his real assessment of himself and you know he's driving in his car and he's like, I won't get my kids cell phones because, you know, I'm driving in my car and you know I hear a Bruce Springsteen song come on the radio and it brings back to a time where I was lonely and desperate and instead of getting on my phone and texting 50 people, hey, you know, hoping for a response of, oh, hey, how you doing, or whatever that we all do, and or we all think about doing, and he let the song play and let what he called the forever empty hit, which is you know, the desperation that you talked about, the forever empty.
Yeah.
And it was so brilliant of his assessment and getting that. I think getting that foot in the door and creating that crack with humor in any way possible. You know, just like Jesus with story and parable, mm-hmm. or whatever, mm-hmm. Of just creating that crack that can expose, you know, what Jesus himself or what John calls the light in the darkness, mm-hmm. you know, of bringing the light to the darkness and you know, Louis C.K. saying, I just let it hit me like a ton of bricks, and I cried, I wept in the car because the forever empty.
Yeah.
I feel like what, you know, humor is such a, and the satire is that light in there, mm-hmm. To expose us.
Yeah. So. Yeah. That's beautiful. Thank you. I thought about the parables too, that parables is the same way of kind of, it's interesting that Jesus didn't speak in these truisms or, and taught more by story than by straight line argument. I think it might be lunchtime. So thank you guys so much for coming, and let's eat.